Welcome, everyone, to the talking show on K-Chung Radio, Los Angeles' only micro-broadcasting arts radio station.
That's right. We're the only ones. We are the only micro-broadcasting radio station in Los Angeles that matters.
That's right, Steve. We're the only one, right? I mean, there's no other ones like in Santa Monica or something, or maybe even Pasadena.
Well, actually, check this out. Get this. So you know that thing where it's like, I'm from North Pasadena? Have you heard that one? So someone lives in Pasadena, but they say, I live in North Pasadena, because they don't want to be associated with, I guess, the rest of Pasadena. And they want to be closer to, you know, actual Los Angeles, so they want to feel cooler. So they say, I'm from North Pasadena. And you know what I'm talking about, right? I hear that there's a K-Chung ripoff station in North Pasadena. Yeah. I know, right? Can you believe that? Yeah, anyway. So that's what I heard.
Good to know. I'm Nicholas Miller here with Steve Cato, tireless hosts on The Talking Show.
That's right.
Ready to bring you yet another amazing performance.
Not tired.
That we have curated here for you tonight. An excellent piece of talking by the rare and impeccable Eli Wallach. And I'm going to do something we don't normally do here on The Talking Show. I'm going to give you a little bit of background information on Eli, because a lot of you may not be as familiar with Eli as you have been with our previous guests. So here's a little bit about Eli's early life. Eli Wallach was born in Red Hook, Brooklyn at 166 Union Street, the son of Polish Jewish immigrants Bertha and Abraham Wallach. They were the only Jewish family in an otherwise predominantly Italian-American neighborhood. His parents owned Bertha's, a candy store. Wallach graduated in 1936 from the University of Texas at Austin with a degree in history, and in 1938 received a master's degree in education from the City College of New York. He gained his first method experience at the neighborhood Playhouse School Theater in New York City. While attending the University of Texas, Wallach performed in a play with fellow students Ann Sheridan and Walter Cronkite. Wallach served as a United States Army Staff Sergeant in a military hospital in Hawaii during World War II. He was soon sent to Officer Candidate School in Abilene, Texas, to train as a medical administrative officer. He graduated as a second lieutenant and was sent to Madison Barracks in upstate New York. He promptly shipped to Casablanca and later, in the war, to France. It was there that a superior discovered his acting history and asked him to form a show for the patients. He and other members from his unit wrote a play called Is This the Army?, which was inspired by Irving Berlin's This Is the Army. In the comedic play, Wallach and other men clowned around as various dictators, with Wallach portraying Adolf Hitler, the leader of Nazi Germany.
Wow. Wow, what an amazing background. That is quite the tale.
That's right, Steve. We've got quite a special and somewhat harrowing performance in store for you by Mr. Wallach. So everyone, try to remain calm. Be prepared for a little tension as we listen to the soothing voice of Eli Herschel Wallach.
The misty rings around the street lamps were gone by the time daylight began to brighten the sky in the east, and by 9 o'clock the day was clear and warm, the beginning of Indian summer's final brief passage, perhaps. Ralph went downstairs as soon as Good Morning America was over, determined to tell McGovern what had been happening to him, or as much as he dared, anyway, before he could lose his nerve. Standing outside the door of the downstairs apartment, however, he could hear the shower running and the mercifully distant sound of William D. McGovern singing, "I Left My Heart in San Francisco." Ralph went out to the porch, stuck his hands in his back pockets, and read the day like a catalogue. There was nothing, he reflected, really nothing in the world like October sunshine. He could almost feel his night miseries draining away. They would undoubtedly be back, but for now he felt all right. Tired and muzzy-headed, yes, but still pretty much all right. The day was more than pretty, it was downright gorgeous, and Ralph doubted there would be another as good before next May. He decided he would be a fool not to take advantage of it. A walk up to the Harris Avenue extension and back again would take half an hour, 45 minutes if there happened to be someone up there worth batting a little breeze with. And by then, Bill would be showered, shaved, combed, and dressed, also ready to lend the sympathetic ear, if Ralph was lucky. He walked as far as the picnic area outside the county airport fence without quite admitting to himself that he was hoping to come across old Dor. If he did, perhaps the two of them could talk a little poetry, Stephen Dobbins, for instance, or maybe even a bit of philosophy. They might start that part of their conversation with Dorrance explaining what long-time business was and why he believed Ralph shouldn't mess in with it. Except Dorrance wasn't at the picnic area. No one was there but Don Veazey, who wanted to explain to Ralph why Bill Clinton was doing such a horrible job as president, and why it would have been better for the good old U.S. of A. if the American people had elected that fiscal genius Ross Perot. Ralph, who had voted for Clinton and actually thought the man was doing a pretty good job, listened long enough to be polite, then said he had an appointment to have his hair cut. It was the only thing he could think of on short notice. "Something else, too," Don blared after him. "That uppity wife of his. Woman's a lesbian, I can always tell, you know how? I look at their shoes. Shoes is like a secret code with them. They always wear those ones with the square toes and..." "See you, Don," Ralph called back and beat a hasty retreat. He'd gone about a quarter of a mile back down the hill when the day exploded silently all around him. He was opposite May Locker's house when it happened. He stopped dead in his tracks, staring down Harris Avenue with wide, unbelieving eyes. His right hand was pressed against the base of his throat and his mouth hung open. He looked like a man having a heart attack. And while his heart seemed all right, for the time being anyway, he certainly felt as if he were having some kind of an attack. Nothing he had seen this fall had prepared him for this. Ralph didn't think anything could have prepared him for this. That other world, the secret world of auras, had come into view again. And this time there was more of it than Ralph had ever dreamed. So much that he wondered fleetingly if it was possible for a person to die of perceptual overload. Upper Harris Avenue was a fiercely glowing wonderland, filled with overlapping spheres and cones and crescents of color. The trees, which were still a week or more from the climax of their fall transformation, nonetheless burned like torches in Ralph's eyes and mind. The sky had gone past color. It was a vast blue sonic boom. The telephone lines on Derry's west side were still above ground, and Ralph stared fixedly at them, vaguely aware that he had stopped breathing and should probably start again soon if he didn't want to pass out. Jagged yellow spirals were running briskly up and down the black wires, reminding Ralph of how barber poles had looked when he was a kid. Every now and then this bumblebee pattern was broken by a spiky red vertical stroke or a green flash that seemed to spread both ways at once, obliterating the yellow rings for a moment before fading out. Thank you. watching people talk, he thought numbly. Do you know that, Ralph? Aunt Sadie in Dallas is chatting with her favorite nephew, who lives in Derry. A farmer in Haven is joined with a dealer he buys his tractor parts from. A minister is trying to help a troubled parishioner. Those are voices, and I think the bright strokes and flashes are coming from people in the grip of some strong emotion. Love or hate, happiness or jealousy. And Ralph sensed that all he was seeing and all he was feeling was not all. That there was a whole world still waiting just beyond the current reach of his senses. Enough, perhaps, to make even what he was seeing now seem faint and faded. And if there was more, how could he possibly bear it without going mad? Not even putting his eyes out would help. He understood somehow that his sense of seeing these things came mostly from his lifelong acceptance of sight as his primary sense. But there was, in fact, a lot more than seeing going on here. In order to prove this to himself, he closed his eyes and went right on seeing Harris Avenue. It was as if his eyelids had turned to glass. The only difference was that all the usual colors had reversed themselves, creating a world that looked like the negative of a color photograph. The trees were no longer orange and yellow, but the bright, unnatural green of lime Gatorade. The surface of Harris Avenue, repaved with fresh asphalt in June, had become a great white way, and the sky was an amazing red lake. He opened his eyes again, almost positive that the auras would be gone. But they weren't. The world still boomed and rolled with color and movement and deep, resonating sound. When do I start seeing them? Ralph wondered as he began to walk slowly down the hill again. When do the little bald doctors start coming out of the woodwork? There were no doctors in evidence, however, bald or otherwise. No angels in the architecture. No devils peering up from the sewer gratings. There was only... Look out, Roberts! Watch where you're going, can't you? The words, harsh and a little alarmed, seemed to have actual physical texture. It was like running a hand over oak paneling in some ancient abbey or ancestral hall. Ralph stopped short and saw Mrs. Perrine from down the street. She had stepped off the sidewalk into the gutter to keep from being bowled over like a tenpin, and now she stood ankle-deep in fallen leaves, holding her net shopping bag in one hand and glaring at Ralph from beneath her thick salt-and-pepper eyebrows. The aura which surrounded her was the firm, no-nonsense gray of a West Point uniform. "Are you drunk, Roberts?" she asked in a clipped voice. And suddenly the riot of color and sensation fell out of the world, and it was just Harris Avenue again, drowsing its way through a lovely weekday morning in mid-autumn. "Drunk? Me? Not at all. Sober as a judge, honest." He held out his hand to her. Mrs. Perrine, over 80, but not giving in to it so much as a single inch, looked at it as if she believed Ralph might have a joy buzzer hidden in his palm. "Wouldn't put it past you, Roberts," a cool gray eye said. "Wouldn't put it past you at all." She stepped back onto the sidewalk without Ralph's aid. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Perrine, I wasn't watching where I was going." "No, you certainly weren't. Lollygagging along with your mouth hanging open is what you were doing. You looked like the village idiot." "Sorry," he repeated, and then had to bite his tongue to stifle a bray of laughter. "Hm." Mrs. Perrine looked him slowly up and down like a marine drill sergeant inspecting a raw recruit. "There's a rip under the arm of that shirt, Roberts." Ralph raised his left arm and looked. There was indeed a large rip in his favorite plaid shirt. He could look through it and see the bandage with its dried spot of blood. Also an unsightly tangle of old man armpit hair. He lowered his arm hurriedly, feeling a blush rising in his cheeks. "Humph," Mrs. Perrine said again, expressing everything she needed to express on the subject of Ralph Roberts without recourse to a single vowel. "Drop it off at the house, if you like. Any other mending you might have as well. I can still run a needle, you know." "Oh, yes, I'll bet you can, Mrs. Perrine." Mrs. Perrine now gave him a look which said, "You're a dried-up old ass-kisser, Ralph Roberts, but I suppose you can't help it." Not in the afternoon, she said. I help make dinner at the homeless shelter in the afternoons and help serve it out at 5. It's God's work. Yes, I'm sure it... There'll be no homeless in heaven, Roberts. You can count on that. No ripped shirts either, I'm sure. But while we're here, we have to get along and make do. It's our job. And I, for one, am doing spectacularly well at it, Mrs. Perrine's face proclaimed. Bring your mending in the morning or in the evening, Roberts. Don't stand on ceremony, but don't you show up at my doorstep after 8:30. I go to bed at 9. That's very kind of you, Mrs. Perrine, Ralph said, and had to bite his tongue again. He was aware that very soon this trick would cease to work. Soon it was going to be a case of laugh or die. Not at all. Christian duty. Also, Carolyn was a friend of mine. Thank you, Ralph said. Terrible about May Locker, wasn't it? No, Mrs. Perrine said. God's mercy. And she glided upon her way before Ralph could say another word. Her spine was so excruciatingly straight that it hurt him to look at it. He walked on a dozen steps, then could hold it no longer. He leaned a forearm against the telephone pole, pressed his mouth to his arm, and laughed as quietly as he could, laughed until tears poured down his cheeks. When the fit, and that was what it really felt like, a kind of hysterical seizure, had passed, Ralph raised his head and looked around with attentive, curious, slightly teary eyes. He saw nothing that anyone else couldn't see as well, and that was a relief. But he will come back, Ralph. You know it will, all of it. Yes, he supposed he did know it, but that was for later. Right now he had some talking to do. When Ralph finally arrived back from his amazing journey up the street, McGovern was sitting in his chair on the porch and idling through the morning paper. As Ralph turned up the walk, he came to a sudden decision. He would tell Bill a lot, but not everything. One of the things he would definitely leave out was how much the two guys he'd seen coming out of Mrs. Locker's house had looked like the aliens in the tabloids for sale at the Red Apple. McGovern looked up as he climbed the steps. Hello, Ralph. Hi, Bill. Can I talk to you about something? Of course. He closed the paper and folded it carefully. They finally took my old friend Bob Paulhurst to the hospital yesterday. Oh, I thought you expected that to happen sooner. I did. Everybody did. He fooled us. In fact, he seemed to be getting better, of the pneumonia at least. And then he relapsed. He had a breathing arrest yesterday around noon, and his niece thought he was going to die before the ambulance got there. He didn't, though, and now he seems to have stabilized again. McGovern looked up the street and sighed. May Locker pops off in the middle of the night, and Bob just keeps chugging along. What a world, huh? I guess so. What did you want to talk about? Have you finally decided to pop the question to Lois? Want a little fatherly advice on how to handle it? I need advice, all right, but not about my love life. Spill it, McGovern said tersely. Ralph did, gratified and more than a little relieved by McGovern's silent attentiveness. He began by sketching in things Bill already knew about. The incident between Ed and the truck driver in the summer of 92, and how similar Ed's rantings on that occasion had been to the things he had said on the day he had beaten Helen for signing the petition. As Ralph spoke, he began to feel more strongly than ever that there were connections between all the odd things which had been happening to him, connections he could almost see. He told McGovern about the auras, although not about the silent cataclysm he had experienced less than half an hour before. That was also further than he was willing to go, at least for the time being. McGovern knew about Charlie Pickering's attack on Ralph, of course, and that Ralph had averted a much more serious injury by using the spray Helen and her friend had given him. But now Ralph told him something he had held back on Sunday night, when he'd told McGovern about the attack over a scratch dinner, how the spray can had magically appeared in his jacket pocket. Except, he said, he suspected that the magician had been Old Dore. Holy shit, McGovern exclaimed. You've been living dangerously, Ralph. I guess so. How much of this have you told Johnny Lydecker? Very little, Ralph started to say, then realized that even that would be an exaggeration. Almost none of it. And there's something else I haven't told him. Something a lot more, well, a lot more substantive, I guess. to do with what happened up there. He pointed toward Maylocker's house, where a couple of blue and white vans had just pulled up. Maine State Police was written on the sides. Ralph assumed they were the forensics people Lydecker had mentioned. May? McGuffin leaned a little forward in his chair. You know something about what happened to May? I think I do. Speaking carefully, moving from word to word like a man using stepping stones to cross a treacherous brook, Ralph told McGuffin about waking up, going into the living room, and seeing two men come out of Mrs. Locker's house. He recounted his successful rummage for the binoculars and told McGuffin about the scissors he had seen one of the men carrying. He did not mention his nightmare of Carolyn or the glowing tracks, and he most certainly did not mention his belated impression that the two men might have come right through the door. That would have finished off any remaining tatters of credibility he might still possess. He ended with his anonymous call to 911 and then sat in his chair looking at McGuffin anxiously. McGuffin shook his head as if to clear it. Auras? Oracles? Mysterious housebreakers with scissors? You have been living dangerously. What do you think, Bill? McGuffin sat quietly for several moments. He had rolled his newspaper up while Ralph was talking, and now he began to tap it absently against his leg. Ralph felt an urge to phrase his question even more bluntly. Do you think I'm crazy, Bill? And quashed it. Did he really believe that was the sort of question to which people gave honest answers, at least without a healthy shot of sodium pentothal first? That Bill might say, oh, yes, I think you're just as crazy as a bedbug, Ralphie baby, so why don't we call Juniper Hill right away and see if they have a bed for you? Not very likely, and since any answer Bill gave would mean nothing, it was better to forego the question. I don't exactly know what I think, Bill said at last. Not yet, at least. What did they look like? Their faces were hard to make out, even with the binoculars, Ralph said. His voice was as steady as it had been yesterday when he had denied making the 911 call. You probably don't have any idea of how old they were, either. No. Could either of them have been our old pal from up the street? Ed Deepno? Ralph looked at McGovern in surprise. No, neither one was Ed. What about Pickering? No, not Ed, not Charlie Pickering. I would have known either of them. What are you driving at? That my mind just sort of buckled and put the two guys who'd caused me the most stress in the last few months on Maylocker's front stoop? Of course not, McGuffin replied. But the steady tap-tap-tap of the newspaper against his leg paused, and his eyes flickered. Ralph felt a sinking in the pit of his stomach. Yes, that was in fact exactly what McGuffin had been driving at. And it wasn't really so surprising, was it? Maybe not, but it didn't change that sinking feeling. And Johnny said all the doors were locked. Yes, from the inside. But... McGuffin got up from his chair so suddenly that for one crazy moment, Ralph had the idea that he was going to run away, perhaps screaming, "Watch out for Roberts! He's gone crazy!" as he went. But instead of bolting down the steps, he turned toward the door leading back into the house. In some ways, Ralph found this even more alarming. What are you going to do? Call Larry Perrault, McGuffin said, May's younger brother. He still lives out in Cardville. She'll be buried in Cardville, I imagine. McGuffin gave Ralph a strange, speculative look. What did you think I was going to do? I don't know, Ralph said uneasily. For a second there, I thought you were going to run away like the gingerbread man. Nope. McGuffin reached out and patted him on the shoulder. But to Ralph, the gesture felt cold and comfortless, perfunctory. What does Mrs. Locker's brother have to do with any of this? Johnny said they sent May's body down to Augusta for a more comprehensive autopsy, right? Well, I think the word he actually used was post-mortem. McGuffin waved this away. Same difference, believe me. If anything odd does crop up, anything suggesting that she was murdered, Larry would have to be informed. He's her only close living relative. Yes, but won't he wonder what your interest is? Oh, I don't think we have to worry about that, McGuffin said, speaking in a soothing tone Ralph didn't care for at all. "I'll say the police have sealed off the house, and that the old Harris Avenue rumor mill is turning briskly. He knows May and I were school chums, and that I visited her regularly over the last couple of years. Larry and I aren't crazy about each other, but we get along reasonably well. He'll tell me what I want to know, if for no other reason than that we're both Cardville survivors. Get it?" "I guess so, but..." "I hope so," McGovern said, and suddenly he looked like a very old and very ugly reptile. "A Gila monster, or perhaps a basilisk lizard." He pointed a finger at Ralph. "I'm not a stupid man, and I do know how to respect a confidence. Your face just now said you weren't sure about that, and I resent it. I resent the hell out of it." "I'm sorry," Ralph said. He was stunned by McGovern's outburst. McGovern looked at him a moment longer with his leathery lips pulled back against his two large dentures, then nodded. "Yeah, okay. Apology accepted. You've been sleeping like shit. I have to factor that into the equation. And as for me, I can't seem to get Bob Paulhurst off my mind." He heaved one of his weightiest poor old Bill sighs. "Listen, if you'd prefer me not to try calling May's brother..." "No, no," Ralph said, thinking that what he'd like to do was roll the clock back 10 minutes or so and cancel this entire conversation. And then a sentiment he was sure Bill McGovern would appreciate floated into his mind, fully constructed and ready for use. "I'm sorry if I impugned your discretion." McGovern smiled, reluctantly at first, and then with his whole face. "Now I know what keeps you awake, thinking up crap like that. Sit still, Ralph, and think good thoughts about a hippopotamus, as my mother used to say. I'll be right back. Probably won't even catch him in, you know. Funeral arrangements and all that. Want to look at the paper while you wait?" "Sure, thanks." McGovern handed him the paper, which still retained the tube shape into which it had been rolled, then went inside. Ralph glanced at the front page. The headline read, "Pro-choice, pro-life advocates ready for activists' arrival." The story was flanked by two news photographs. One showed half a dozen young women making signs which said things like, "Our bodies, our choice, and it's a brand new day in Derry." The other showed picketers marching in front of Woman Care. They carried no signs and needed none. The hooded black robes they wore and the scythes they carried said it all. Ralph heaved a sigh of his own, dropped the paper onto the seat of the rocking chair beside him, and watched Tuesday morning unfold along Harris Avenue. It occurred to him that McGovern might well be on the phone with John Lydecker rather than Larry Perrault, and that the two of them might at this very moment be having a little student-teacher conference about that nutty old insomniac, Ralph Roberts. "Just thought you'd like to know who really made that 911 call, Johnny." "Thanks, Prof. We were pretty sure anyway, but it's good to get confirmation. I imagine he's harmless. I actually sort of like him." Ralph pushed away his speculations about who Bill might or might not be calling. It was easier just to sit here and not think at all. Not even good thoughts about a hippopotamus. Easier to watch the Budweiser truck lumber into the Red Apple parking lot, pausing to give courtesy to the Magazines Incorporated van, which had dropped off this week's ration of tabloids, magazines, and paperbacks, and was now leaving. Easier to watch old Harriet Bennigan, who made Mrs. Perrine look like a spring chicken, bent over her walker in a bright red fall coat, out for her morning lurch. Easier to watch the young girl, who was wearing jeans, an oversized white T-shirt, and a man's hat about 4 sizes too big for her, jumping rope in the weedy vacant lot between Frank's Bakery and Vicky Moon's Tanning Saloon. Body wraps are specialty. Easier to watch the girl's small hands penduluming up and down. Easier to listen as she chanted her endless, shuttling rhyme. 3, 6, 9, the goose drank wine. Some distant part of Ralph's mind realized, with great astonishment, that he was on the verge of going to sleep as he sat here on the porch steps. At the same time this was happening, the auras were creeping into the world again, filling it with fabulous colors and motions. It was wonderful, but something was wrong with it. Something. What? The girl jumping rope in the vacant lot. She was wrong. Her denim-clad legs pumped up and down like the bobbin of a sewing machine. Her shadow jumped next to her on the jumbled pavement of an ancient alley overgrown with weeds and sunflowers. The rope whirled up and down, all around, up and down and all around. Not an oversized T-shirt, though. He'd been wrong about that. The figure was wearing a smock, a white smock, like the kind worn by actors in the old TV dock operas. 369, hun, the goose drank wine. The monkey chewed tobacco on the streetcar line. A cloud blocked the sun, and a grim green light sailed across the day, driving it underwater. Ralph's skin first chilled, then broke out in goosebumps. The girl's pumping shadow disappeared. She looked up at Ralph, and he saw she wasn't a little girl at all. The creature looking at him was a man about 4 feet tall. Ralph had first taken the hat-shadowed face for that of a child, because it was utterly smooth, unmarked by so much as a single line. And yet, despite that, it conveyed a clear feeling to Ralph, a sense of evil, of malignity, beyond the comprehension of a sane mind. That's it, Ralph thought numbly, staring at the skipping creature. That's exactly it. Whatever the thing over there is, it's insane, totally gone. The creature might have read Ralph's thought, for at that moment, its lips skinned back in a grin that was both coy and nasty, as if the two of them shared some unpleasant secret. And he was sure, yes, quite sure, almost positive, that it was somehow chanting through its grin, doing it without moving its lips in the slightest. The line broke, the monkey got choked, and they all died together in a little low boat. It was neither of the two little bald doctors Ralph had seen coming out of Mrs. Locker's. He was almost positive of that. Related to them, maybe, but not the same. It was... The creature threw its jump rope away. The rope turned first yellow and then red, seeming to give off sparks as it flew through the air. The small figure, Doc Number 3, stared at Ralph, grinning, and Ralph suddenly realized something else. Something which filled him with horror. He finally recognized the hat the creature was wearing. It was Bill McGovern's missing Panama. Again, it was as if the creature had read his mind. It dragged the hat from its head, revealing the round, hairless skull beneath, and waved McGovern's Panama in the air as if it were a cowpoke astride a bucking bronco. It continued to grin its unspeakable grin as it waved the hat. Suddenly it pointed at Ralph as if mocking him. Then it clapped the hat back on its head and darted into the narrow, weed-choked opening between the tanning salon and the bakery. The sun sailed free of the cloud which had covered it, and the shifting brightness of the auras began to fade once more. A moment or two after the creature had disappeared, it was just Harris Avenue in front of him again. Boring old Harris Avenue, the same as always. Ralph pulled a shuddering breath, remembering the madness in that small, grinning face. Remembering the way it had pointed. The monkey got choked at him, as if they all died together in a little rowboat, mocking him. "Tell me I fell asleep," he whispered hoarsely. "Tell me I fell asleep and dreamed that little bugger." The door opened behind him. "Oh, my, talking to yourself?" McGovern said. "Must have money in the bank, Ralphie." "Yeah, about enough to cover my burial expenses," Ralph said. To himself, he sounded like a man who has just suffered a terrible shock and is still trying to cope with the residual fright. He half expected Bill to dart forward, face filling with concern, or maybe just suspicion, to ask what was wrong. McGovern did nothing of the sort. He plumped into the rocking chair, crossed his arms over his narrow chest in a brooding X, and looked out at Harris Avenue, the stage upon which he and Ralph and Lois and Dorrance Marsteller and so many other old folks, we golden ages in McGovernese, were destined to play out their often boring and sometimes painful last act. "Suppose I told him about his hat," Ralph thought. "Suppose I just opened the conversation by saying, 'Bill, I also know what happened to your Panama. Some badass relation to the guys I saw last night has got it.'" He wears it when he jumps rope between the bakery and the tanning salon. If Bill had any lingering doubts about his sanity, that little newsflash would certainly set him to rest. Yep. Ralph kept his mouth shut. Sorry I was gone so long, McGovern said. Larry claimed I just caught him going out the door to the funeral parlor. But before I could ask my questions and get away, he'd rehashed half of May's life and damn near all of his own. Talked nonstop for 45 minutes. Positive this was an exaggeration. McGovern had surely been gone 5 minutes, tops. Ralph glanced at his watch and was astounded to see it was 11:15. He looked up the street and saw that Mrs. Bennigan had disappeared. So had the Budweiser truck. Had he been asleep? It seemed that he must have been. But he could not for the life of him find the break in his conscious perceptions. Oh, come on, don't be dense. You were sleeping when you saw the little bald guy. Dreamed the little bald guy. That made perfect sense. Even the fact that it had been wearing Bill's Panama made sense. The same hat had shown up in his nightmare about Carolyn. It had been between Rosalie's paws in that one. Except this time he hadn't been dreaming. He was sure of it. Well, almost sure. "Aren't you going to ask me what May's brother said?" McGovern sounded slightly piqued. "Sorry," Ralph said. "I was wool-gathering, I guess." "Forgiven, my son. Provided you listen closely from here on out, that is. The detective in charge of the case, Funderburk, I'm pretty sure it's Utterback, Steve Utterback." McGovern waved his hand airily, his most common response to being corrected on some point. "Whatever. Anyway, he called Larry and said the autopsy showed nothing but natural causes. The thing they were most concerned about, in light of your call, was that May had been scared into a heart attack, literally frightened to death by housebreakers. The doors being locked from the inside, and the lack of missing valuables militated against that, of course. But they took your call seriously enough to investigate the possibility." His half-reproachful tone, as if Ralph had wantonly poured glue into the gears of some usually smooth-running machine, made Ralph feel impatient. "Of course they took it seriously. I saw two guys leaving her house and reported it to the authorities. When they got there, they found the lady dead. How could they not take it seriously? Why didn't you give your name when you made the call?" "I don't know." "What difference does it make? And how in God's name can they be sure she wasn't scared into a heart attack?" "I don't know if they can be 100% sure," McGovern said, now sounding a bit testy himself. "But I guess it must be close to that if they're turning May's body over to her brother for burial. It's probably a blood test of some kind. All I know is that this guy Funderburk, Utterback, told Larry that May probably died in her sleep." McGovern crossed his legs, fiddled with the creases in his blue slacks, then gave Ralph a clear and piercing look. "I'm going to give you some advice, so listen up. Go to the doctor. Now, today. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go directly to Litchfield. This is getting heavy." The ones I saw coming out of Mrs. Locker's didn't see me, but this one did, Ralph thought. It saw me, and it pointed at me. For all I know, it might actually have been looking for me. Now there was a nice paranoid thought. "Ralph, did you hear what I said?" "Yes. I take it you don't believe I actually saw anyone coming out of Mrs. Locker's house." "You take it right. I saw the look on your face just now when I told you I'd been gone 45 minutes. And I also saw the way you looked at your watch. You didn't believe so much time had passed, did you? And the reason you didn't believe it is because you dozed off without even being aware of it. Had yourself a little pocket nap. That's probably what happened to you the other night, Ralph. Only the other night you dreamed up those two guys, and the dream was so real you called 911 when you woke up. Doesn't that make sense?" 369, Ralph thought. "The goose drank wine." "What about the binoculars?" he asked. "They're still sitting on the table beside my chair in the living room. Don't they prove I was awake?" "I don't see how. Maybe you were sleepwalking. Have you thought of that? You say you saw these intruders, but you can't really describe them?" Those orange high-intensity lights. All the doors locked from the inside. Just the same, I... And these auras you talked about. The insomnia is causing them. I'm almost sure of it. Still, it could be more serious than that. Ralph got up, walked down the porch steps, and stood at the head of the walk with his back to McGovern. There was a throbbing at his temples, and his heart was beating hard. Too hard. He didn't just point. I was right the first time. The little son of a bitch mocked me. And he was no dream. Neither were the ones I saw coming out of Mrs. Locker's. I'm sure of it. Of course you are, Ralph, another voice replied. Crazy people are always sure of the crazy things they see and hear. That's what makes them crazy, not the hallucinations themselves. If you really saw what you saw, what happened to Mrs. Bennigan? What happened to the Budweiser truck? How did you lose the 45 minutes McGovern spent on the phone with Larry Perrault? You're experiencing very serious symptoms, McGovern said from behind him, and Ralph thought he heard something terrible in the man's voice. Satisfaction? Could it possibly be satisfaction? One of them had a pair of scissors, Ralph said without turning around. I saw them. Oh, come on, Ralph, think. Use that brain of yours and think. On Sunday afternoon, less than 24 hours before you're due to have acupuncture treatment, a lunatic nearly sticks a knife into you. Is it any wonder that your mind serves up a nightmare featuring a sharp object that night? Hong's pins and Pickering's hunting knife become scissors, that's all. Don't you see that this hypothesis covers all the bases, while what you claim to have seen covers none of them? And I was sleepwalking when I got the binoculars, that's what you think? It's possible, even likely. Same thing with a spray can in my jacket pocket, right? Old Dor didn't have a thing to do with it. I don't care about the spray can or Old Dor, McGovern cried. I care about you. You've been suffering from insomnia since April or May. You've been depressed and disturbed ever since Carolyn died. I have not been depressed, Ralph shouted. Across the street, the mailman paused and looked in their direction before going on down the block toward the park. Have it your own way, McGovern said. You haven't been depressed. You also haven't been sleeping. You're seeing auras, guys creeping out of locked houses in the middle of the night. And then, in a deceptively light voice, McGovern said the thing Ralph had been dreading all along. You want to watch out, old son. You're starting to sound too much like Ed Deepnow for comfort. Ralph turned around. Dull, hot blood pounded behind his face. Why are you being this way? Why are you taking after me this way? I'm not taking after you, Ralph. I'm trying to help you, to be your friend. That's not how it feels. Well, sometimes the truth hurts a little. McGovern said calmly. You need to at least consider the idea that your mind and body are trying to tell you something. Let me ask you a question. Is this the only disturbing dream you've had lately? Ralph thought fleetingly of Carol, buried up to her neck in the sand and screaming about white man tracks. Thought of the bugs which had flooded out of her head. I haven't had any bad dreams lately, he said stiffly. I suppose you don't believe that because it doesn't fit into the little scenario you've created. Ralph, let me ask you something. Do you really believe that my seeing those two men and May Locker turning up dead was just a coincidence? Maybe not. Maybe your physical and emotional upset created conditions favorable to a brief but perfectly genuine psychic event. Ralph was silenced. I believe such things do happen from time to time, McGovern said, standing up. Probably sounds funny, coming from a rational old bird like me, but I do. I'm not out and out saying that is what happened here, but it could have been. What I am sure of is that the two men you think you saw did not in fact exist in the real world. Ralph stood looking up at McGovern with his hands jammed deep into his pockets, and clenched into fists so hard and tight they felt like rocks. He could feel the muscles in his arms thrumming. McGovern came down the porch steps and took him by the arm, gently, just above the elbow. I only think... Ralph pulled his arm away so sharply that McGovern grunted with surprise and stumbled a little on his feet. I know what you think. You're not hearing what I... Oh, I've heard plenty. More than enough. Believe me. And excuse me. I think I'm going for another walk. I need to clear my head. He could feel dull, hot blood pounding away in his cheeks and brow. He tried to throw his brain into some forward gear that would allow it to leave this senseless, impotent rage behind, and couldn't do it. He felt a lot as he had when he had awakened from the dream of Carolyn. His thoughts roared with terror and confusion, and as he started his legs moving, the sense he got was not one of walking but of falling, as he had fallen out of bed yesterday morning. Still, he kept going. Sometimes that was all you could do. "Ralph, you need to see a doctor," McGovern called after him, and Ralph could no longer tell himself that he didn't hear a weird, shrewish pleasure in McGovern's voice. The concern which overlaid it was probably genuine enough, but it was like sweet icing on a sour cake. Not a pharmacist, not a hypnotist, not an acupuncturist. You need to see your own family doctor. Yeah, the guy who buried my wife below the high tide line, he thought in a kind of mental scream. The guy who stuck her in sand up to her neck and then told her she didn't have to worry about drowning as long as she kept taking her Valium and Tylenol 3. Aloud he said, I need to take a walk. That's what I need, and that's all I need. His heartbeat was now slamming into his temples like the short, hard blows of a sledgehammer, and it occurred to him that this was how strokes must happen. If he didn't control himself soon, he was apt to fall down with what his father had called a bad temper apoplexy. He could hear McGovern coming down the walk after him. Don't touch me, Bill, Ralph thought. Don't even put your hand on my shoulder, because I'm probably going to turn around and slug you if you do. I'm trying to help you, don't you see that? McGovern shouted. The mailman on the other side of the street had stopped again to watch them. And outside the Red Apple, Carl, the guy who worked mornings, and Sue, the young woman who worked afternoons, were gawking frankly across the street at them. Carl, he saw, had a bag of hamburger buns in one hand. It was really sort of amazing, the things you saw at a time like this, although not as amazing as some of the things he had already seen that morning. The things you thought you saw, Ralph, a traitor voice whispered softly from deep inside his head. Walk, Ralph muttered desperately. Just a damn walk. A mind movie had begun to play in his head. It was an unpleasant one, the sort of film he rarely went to see, even if he had seen everything else that was playing at the cinema center. The soundtrack to this mental horror flick seemed to be Pop Goes the Weasel, of all things. Let me tell you something, Ralph. At our age, mental illness is common. At our age, it's common as hell. So go see your doctor. Mrs. Bennigan was now standing on her stoop, her walker abandoned at the foot of the front steps. She was still wearing her bright red fall coat, and her mouth appeared to be hanging open as she stared down the street at them. Do you hear me, Ralph? I hope you do. I just hope you do. Ralph walked faster, hunching his shoulders as if against a cold wind. Suppose he just keeps on yelling, louder and louder. Suppose he follows me right up the street. If he does that, people will think he's the one who's gone crazy, he told himself. But this idea had no power to soothe him. In his mind, he continued to hear a piano playing a children's tune. No, not really playing. Picking it out in nursery school plinks and plonks. All around the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. The monkey thought 'twas all in fun. Pop goes the weasel. And now Ralph began to see the old people of Harris Avenue, the ones who bought their insurance from companies that advertised on cable TV, the ones with the gallstones and the skin tumors, the ones whose memories were diminishing even as their prostates enlarged. The ones who were living on Social Security and peering at the world through thickening cataracts instead of rose-colored glasses. These were the people who now read all the mail which came addressed to occupant and scanned the supermarket advertising circulars for specials on canned goods and generic frozen dinners. He saw them dressed in grotesque short pants and fluffy short skirts, saw them wearing beanies and T-shirts which showcased such characters as Beavis and Butthead and Rude Dog. He saw them, in short, as the world's oldest preschoolers. They were marching around a double row of chairs as a small bald man in a white smock played Pop Goes the Weasel on the piano. Another baldy filched the chairs one by one, and when the music stopped and everyone sat down, one person, this time it had been May Locker, next time it would probably be McGovern's old department head, was left standing. That person would have to leave the room, of course. And Ralph heard McGovern laughing. Laughing because he'd found a seat again. Maybe May Locker was dead, Bob Paulhurst dying, Ralph Roberts losing his marbles. But he was still all right. William D. McGovern, Esquire, was still fine, still dandy, still vertical, and taking nourishment, still able to find a chair when the music stopped. Ralph walked faster still, shoulders hunched even higher, anticipating another fusillade of advice and admonition. He thought it unlikely that McGovern would actually follow him up the street, but not entirely out of the question. If McGovern was angry enough, he might do just that, remonstrating, telling Ralph to stop fooling around and go to the doctor, reminding him that the piano could stop any time, any old time at all, and if he didn't find a chair while the finding was good, he might be out of luck forever. No more shouts came, however. He thought of looking back to see where McGovern was, then thought better of it. If he saw Ralph looking back, it might set him off all over again. Best to just keep going. So Ralph lengthened his stride, heading back in the direction of the airport again, without even thinking about it, walking with his head down, trying not to hear the relentless piano, trying not to see the old children marching around the chairs, trying not to see the terrified eyes above their make-believe smiles. It came to him as he walked that his hopes had been denied. He'd been pushed into the tunnel after all, and the dark was all around him.
Whoa. Wow. Yeah. I'm right there with you, Steve. That was incredibly intense and very weird.
Yeah.
Very.
So weird. Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, well, go ahead, Steve. I know you want to compare Mr. Wallach to one of our previous guests here on The Talking Joke. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm not going to stop you.
Well, I guess thanks for the prompting. I think that it struck me halfway through about that Eli Wallach's delivery had this regional accent, plain speech sort of twang that was sort of like a Robert Ashley from another place almost. And I think the fact that he was talking about sort of magical things happening in and around senior citizens also brought the idea, at least, of Robert Ashley to mind. I don't know. Don't you feel like that's a possibility? Or a basis for comparison, maybe?
Yeah. And in a rare moment of agreement, I am on your side, Steve. Whoa. I completely agree. I couldn't agree more.
I don't know what's weirder, that talking or what you just said.
Yeah, well, all I can say is that
weird.
We needed to get this one off our chests. You know, October's coming. It's getting colder. For whatever reason, the mood is a little bit scarier and creepier.
Yeah.
But we will try not to scare you gentle listeners too much during the next show. We'll do something a little bit upbeat. But that's all we have for you this evening, this wonderful, lovely evening. Try to get some rest. Don't stay up all night. It's not good for your eyes. Tune in to us next week here on The Talking Show. on Kaechung Radio. Good night.
Hang in there.